You're listening to The Point. In 1883, Frank Dubois gained national attention for his life in rural Wisconsin. There he was known as a hardworking man married to a young woman named Gertrude Fuller. What drew national attention to his seemingly unremarkable life was that he was revealed to be anatomically female. In the new book, True Sex, The Lives of Trans Men at the Turn of the 20th Century, Emily Skidmore uncovers the stories of 18 trans men who lived in the United States between 1876 and 1936. Despite their sort of unexceptional quality, their lives were surprising and moving, challenging, much of what we know about queer history. Emily Skidmore is an assistant professor of history at Texas Tech University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So how did you come across the story of Frank Dubois? And as someone who has studied gender history, what struck you about his story?
Sure. So I did a lot of my research using digital databases. So one of the exciting things about being a historian in 2017 or in 2008 when my research began is how readily available historical newspapers are. And so I was interested in stories of cross-dressing and how these stories were represented in newspapers. And so what I did was just doing similar to a Google search that we would do, did a word search of phrases like lived as a man. Mm-hmm. And I found a lot of stories, and Dubois' story is one of the ones that popped up and immediately captured my attention, in part because it's one of the earliest stories of my book. It's from 1883. And often, you know, when you hear about transgender issues in the media, there's often the suggestion that these are new. Mm-hmm. And so to have a very old story from 1883, it was very striking to me.
So put that time period into context for us. What was life like in the United States in the late 1800s, and how were the roles of men and women defined?
Sure. So one of the things that drew me to this period is that this is the time in which you have the rise of a field called sexology, which is a scientific study of sex roles and sexuality. Because up to this point, there wasn't a category of homosexuality. Right? Your sex acts didn't necessarily correspond to a sexual identity. And it wasn't until sexologists defined, created a label of homosexuality, created a label of gay and lesbian, that there came to be an association between what you did in the bedroom, mm-hmm. and your identity. One of the things that drew me to this period is the fact that it's this interesting period where things are sort of in flux, where we have new ideas about what sex means, new ideas about what gender means, and these ideas are circulating in the realm of scientific discourse. These ideas are circulating in courtrooms, and I was interested in thinking about how these ideas sort of percolated down to ground level. Mm-hmm. So simply because we have new identity categories that scientists are talking about, did that change the ways in which everyday people thought about their neighbors or thought about their friends?
Did it?
So one of the interesting things that I found in my book is that it took a long time. And even as on the national level, cross-dressing in women is increasingly associated with lesbianism and with pathology, at the local level, if an individual was discovered to be anatomically female but had been living as a man, if their life as a man was deemed to be good, right? Mm-hmm. If they had been a productive member of society, if they had been a good neighbor, a good friend, a hard worker, then their trespasses of gender were seen as rather innocent.
Yeah. Right? Overlooked, yeah. So many of these transgendered men were trying to live quiet lives, mm-hmm. as part of the heterosexual community. What were some of the ways that their true sex was revealed?
Yeah, so often it really happened in one of two ways. So the first way is if the individual died. Mm-hmm. Many of the people in my book lived for decades as men, and it wasn't until the moment they were at the coroner's office or their neighbors came over to help their wives attend to the body that it was discovered that they were not anatomically male in the way that they had, that the community had assumed they were. So that's one way, maybe a primary way. And another way in which these individuals, quote unquote, two sex, was revealed was through engagement with the law, either upon arrest. They're arrested, taken into jail, forced to disrobe, and their anatomy is revealed in that way, or other engagement with other types of law officials, like immigration officials, for example. One of the people I talk about, Frank Woodhull, his true sex was revealed when he was trying to emigrate through Ellis Island.
So did the newspaper articles record the public response to the revelations? And if so, describe some. I mean, you know, like, wow, who, you know, you know, they find out that, you know, Joe Smith down the street is, you know, was born a woman, and all this time we thought he was a man. And do we have any evidence of what the reaction was?
Yeah, so I try to read the newspaper articles as some insight into what the public response was. And what's interesting is that sometimes the public response seemed to be rather nonchalant. That at times, stories of revelation didn't even make it into the front page of the local newspaper. They were hidden on page like 7 next to an ad for candles. And it's like, oh, right. And so-and-so was revealed to be a woman. And sometimes there was surprise, but often the surprise is articulated at the level of national newspapers. So when these stories are talked about in the national press, like large, widely circulating newspapers like the New York World, often we have sensational headlines that scream, you know, woman masqueraded as a man for 15 years and had two wives, things like that. And what's interesting is that I found over 65 cases across the 60-year period of my study, and yet every time that these stories are talked about in the national press, there's constant surprise. And it seems to me that given the fact that on average such stories were reported once a year, that the surprise is sort of manufactured. And it's a way for the press to get around the fact that these stories are happening a lot. And it's a way for them to not have to deal with that if they're constantly acting like this is a surprising event and the most unique story they've ever heard.
There's a cartoon you have in the book depicting the courtroom case of Robert and Margaret Gaffney. And wife was most surprised of all.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is that many of the individuals I write about in the book were married to women or were in relationships to women. And virtually every time, if say the man was arrested or died, and the wife is interviewed, the wife always says, "I had no idea. I had no idea my husband was anatomically female." And that's interesting.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Because on the one hand, you have to wonder, could that be true? But on the other hand, I choose to interpret it in my book as a strategy these wives enacted.
Right.
And it, 'cause it renders them innocent, sexually innocent. Right. They just had no idea.
The terms romantic friendship and lesbian husband were used during that time period.
Your female husband, yeah.
What was the unspoken understanding within the general public that those terms meant homosexuality, or was it something else?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. These terms are rather, I don't want to say ambivalent, but they leave a lot of room for interpretation. And the mores of the day didn't allow for newspapers to have explicit discussions of sex acts in the newspapers. And so it left a lot of room for individual readers to make up their own mind about what was going on within these relationships. Certainly, for a long, long time, historians who have written about particularly the 19th century have suggested that in Victorian America, women were presumed to be asexual or to have to not have any innate sexual drive. And so, therefore, relationships between two women had to be sexually innocent because, you know, sex only happens because men have a sexual appetite. And so without that presence, then two women's relationships, of course, that's innocent.
Right.
There can't be anything going on there because women lack an innate sexuality. My work is sort of rethinking that. I think that certainly women in the 19th century did have sexual drives. And I think society knew that, maybe didn't want to acknowledge it as readily as we do today.
How was homosexuality and gender identity understood or discussed by the medical community? And did that understanding undergo any significant changes during that time?
Mm-hmm. So homosexuality in women was defined as the 1880s, 1890s, was defined through the concept of sexual inversion. And what sexual inversion meant was that same-sex desire is caused by an inversion of one's sex role in their mind. That a woman who desires women because they are masculine. Men, according to the scientists, naturally desired women. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a woman who's masculine, then thereby she desires women. And so that was the first model of homosexuality that that sexologists defined in the 1770s, 1780s, and 1790s. That has a little bit of a hold. It trickles down a little bit in national newspapers. But it doesn't become a defining way in which sexuality is discussed in the media until, say, the 1920s or 1930s.
In the book, you note that in many of the newspaper stories about transgendered men extol their ability to, quote, master the tenets of white masculinity. So what were the tenets of white masculinity at the time, and why do you think this is significant?
Sure. The people I write about, or most of the people I write about, I think they realized that they had to develop strategies to survive. And if they wanted to live as men, then they had to figure out ways in which to make that work. And so one common strategy I find, and I write about in the book, is that these individuals tried to fit in as much as possible. They tried to, live as conventional lives as possible as a way to prevent public scrutiny into their identity. It was a way of survival. Mm-hmm. I write about how many of them tried to embody the tropes of white masculinity, in things like being economically productive, marrying women, and living as conventional men. Mm. Yeah.
Did you find any stories of transgendered men of color in your research?
So, one of the frustrating things about my research is that most of the individuals I found were white. Mm-hmm. And I write about that as well. I write about how the whiteness of most of the people in the book allowed for, at least to a certain extent, the presumption of innocence, right? Because whiteness, one of the privileges of whiteness, is often the presumption of innocence. And that privilege is often something that people of color do not have. So I do write about two individuals of color in the book. One is Ralph Curwenio, who is probably one of my favorite stories of the book. He's an individual who was born in a small town in Indiana in the late 19th century, moved to Chicago, and met a woman in Chicago. And this time, this is around like 1900, and at this time was still living as a woman. He meets another woman, they pursue a relationship, and they decide that they want to live as a married heterosexual couple. And so they are living in Chicago. And instead of simply assuming these identities in Chicago, they move to Milwaukee. They moved to Milwaukee in 1908, which is interesting because we don't often associate Milwaukee as a particularly friendly place for a queer couple to live, particularly a queer couple of color. Ralph Cruenio, his racial identity is a little unclear. We know for sure his father's African-American and his mother was African-American and perhaps Native American as well. But his wife, Mamie White, was African-American as well. And so we have this couple of color moving from Chicago, a city with a large African-American population, a burgeoning queer community in the early 20th century. They moved to Milwaukee. And they moved to Milwaukee, and Milwaukee has a very large immigrant population in the early 20th century, and he is able to pass as an immigrant. He is able to pass as Spanish. Mm-hmm. And actually on the 1910 census, he is marked. So the 1910 census is the first year he appears as male on the federal census, and he appears as white in the, in that census because he's passing as a Spanish immigrant.
Wow. Now, so you're right. We incorporate the stories of these transgendered men in the late 1800s who are choosing to live these quiet lives in rural communities instead of as part of the larger urban queer community. So how does that alter our understanding of queer history?
Yeah, so for a very long time, when historians have written about queer history, it's always, or not always, it's most often written as an urban history. And there's this assumption that in order to be out and to live a queer life, you have to, like, that transition happens alongside a move to an urban area. And I think this still guides a lot of how we think about queer communities today. We often think about queer lives as existing in urban areas and not rural areas. We often think about rural areas as antithetical to happy queer lives, and you know, I understand that in many cases that's true, but there's also a legacy of queerness in rural areas that I was trying to uncover in my book, and I think that that's really significant. The fact that that was one of the things that was most surprising to me about my research is that when, you know, as I mentioned, I found 65 cases of individuals who were assigned female at birth but lived as male for at least 6 months or more between the years 1870 and 1940. And I found a sizable portion, almost 40% of those individuals, chose to live in non-metropolitan areas. And that's really significant because it shows us that these lives could exist in rural areas. And often these individuals, like many individuals at the turn of the 20th century, their lives are marked by movement. They moved around a lot. And so it's not simply that they were born in rural areas and that's where they chose to stay. It's that maybe some of them were born in a rural area and then moved to a different rural area because there was something about that they liked. And I think that's those stories are significant and challenging the ways in which we think about queer history, but also challenging the ways in which we think about rural areas past and present.
Yeah. Now, there are illustrations in the book, but you have a photograph on the cover.
Yes.
Tell us about the photo on the cover. This is a great story.
So on the cover of the book is a picture of Kenneth Lazenby and his girlfriend, Stella Harper. It's a photograph from 1929. And it was taken, I believe it was taken in the a Los Angeles Police Department. Kenneth Lazenby had been arrested shortly before the picture was taken. And I began this research in 2008. And at the time, no one had written about Kenneth Lazenby before. And so shortly before I turned in the final version of the book, I wanted to make sure that no one else had come along and written about Kenneth Lazenby as I had been working on the book. And so I Googled Kenneth Lazenby. And the very first thing that came up was a listing on eBay for a photograph. a photograph of Kenneth Lazenby and Stella Harper, the photograph that is on the cover of the book. And it was from, it was being sold by a company that had purchased photographs from an old newsreel company that had gone defunct. And most of the photographs that they had listed on eBay were of famous individuals. And then stuck in the middle is this picture of Kenneth Lazenby. It's a fantastic photograph of Kenneth in a suit,
with a hat,
yeah. And shoes, and his sock and a tie. Yeah. And so he's wearing nice clothes, but he still looks a little frumpy. Mm-hmm. Like his socks are a little frumpy. I just love the photograph. And one of the things that I love most about it is there's a gesture of affection between the two subjects, between Kenneth Lazenby. Yeah. And his girlfriend.
What were they arrested for?
So they were arrested because a neighbor thought that something fishy was going on and called the police. And they were, I don't know what the reason for why they were initially brought in to the station was, but after once they were there, it was discovered that Kenneth Lazenby had married another woman 4 years before. And then was also a woman or was biologically female. And so these things were discovered, once they were brought into the station. And again, they were, a neighbor called the police on them simply because they weren't sure what was going on in their relationship or in their household. The police went and brought them in.
So how do you hope your book will influence future research into the LGBTQ community? And what are some areas of that history you think are important to further our understanding of this community in this country?
Yeah. So I think that, my biggest hope is that it promotes or prompts others to look at trans history. LGBT history began as a field in the 1980s, and yet still most histories that are written about gays and lesbians. There's not a lot of work on transgender history. It has been some great, great work, but it doesn't receive the same attention as the histories of gays and lesbians. And so I hope that it suggests that there is a long history of gender transgression, and particularly with digital databases, these histories are more readily accessible than ever before. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that it suggests the long and deep history of gender transgression.
Emily Skidmore is an assistant professor of history at Texas Tech University, specializing in the history of gender and sexuality in the United States. Her new book is True Sex, The Lives of Trans Men at the Turn of the 20th Century. We'll have a link to more information about her book at our website, capeandislands.org. Emily, thanks for coming in.
Great. Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.